Welcome to this episode of RF Industry Icons Podcast. I'm Pat Hindle, and today we're talking with Alan Podell, founder of Anzac Electronics and Pacific Monolithics. He's an IEEE Life Fellow and has authored more than 70 papers and has 60 patents in our industry. In addition to consulting for many years, he was also a senior lecturer at Besser Associates. Welcome to the podcast, Alan.
Thanks, Pat. Hi, everybody.
So I wanted to maybe start off with your education. I think you transferred from Delaware to Cornell and majored in physics. You know, what led you into that area of study?
I think I came out of the womb asking questions. Why? And so although I was always interested in engineering, I majored in physics when I went to the University of Delaware because I wanted to understand the underlying laws that were underneath it all. I figured I could put the engineering together if I understood what was the bedrock. And so at Delaware, I took a little bit of engineering and all the physics I could in the 2 years that I was there, and had no intention of leaving University of Delaware, but that was when my father died. My mother thought that I had the intention of working for a company in Connecticut that I had interviewed with to gain experience for my interview with RCA, which was where I was going to work that summer, I figured, and still continue on at the University of Delaware, living in Wilmington, commuting to Morristown, New Jersey, whatever it was. Anyway, none of that worked out because my father died. My mother said she wouldn't forgive herself if I were to stay home and not go to Connecticut for the job of my dreams. So I ended up in Connecticut. Worked for a company, CGS Laboratories, that I'd never heard of before in my life. And it was wonderful. The people there were great. Carl Sonheimer was the president of the company. He subsequently achieved Cuisinart fame, but anyway, Carl was the president of the company, and we got along really well. It was a wonderful summer job, and at the end of the time, Carl said to me, Alan, do you want to stay at the University of Delaware? And I said, gee, my father died, my mother, you know, is a bookkeeper, there's no way for me to go anywhere else. And he said, we'll give you a loan. Would you consider going to Cornell? And that's how I ended up at Cornell. They pulled some strings there. I ended up in my junior year at Cornell with a barely acceptable set of credits for transfer that they accepted because of the strings that were being pulled. And anyway, I worked really hard at Cornell. It was very, very difficult for me because I was making up for lost time, but I made it. And in my last year, I was working on a senior project, which was a broadband transformer design. That was my personal project. And then I was asked to build a parametric amplifier by Les Eastman, was really an absolutely super guy, a world-class human being mensch, just terrific man. And so anyway, he asked me to build this parametric amplifier. He had the parts he was going to get, but he didn't have any way of putting it together. And I was good with my hands. And so thanks to my dad, who was really fantastic. He showed me everything he did. He had me work with him side by side. So yeah, I put this thing together, figured out how we could do it. And it turned out that parametric amplifier ended up at Arecibo Space Telescope down in Puerto Rico, wherever it is, somewhere down there, floating in an island. And anyway, to work on that parametric amplifier, I needed a mixer, a balanced mixer. And I was a visiting engineering physics major in the EE department working on this project. Well, I had the lowest of low priorities. Just below rat was a guy who was from another department who was using their test equipment. And so the only time I could use the necessary test equipment I needed for the parametric amplifier was at night. So I had to stay up all night doing my testing, and it was a really yucky schedule. And so I decided, my God, I'm going to build my this balance mixer isn't very good anyway. I'm going to build my own. So I went into their stock room at Cornell, which was filled with World War surplus garbage, and I wound a mixer, a single balance mixer, using, as it turned out, was microphone wire, but it was close enough to coax to do my job. And you can imagine rubber insulated, anyway, at 400 megahertz. But anyway, it worked. I put my mixer together. It was way better than the general radios thing that I had. So I went back to living a normal life, coming in and working in the lab when normal people worked in the lab, and got that parametric amplifier out the door. And when I graduated college, the Carl, who had been at CGS Laboratories, had been booted out. There was a stock fiddle diddle that went on, and they ganged up on. He had not enough stock to keep them from taking his own company over. And so he was out in the cold, and he had money and no place to go and a lot of energy. So Carl Sondheimer said to me, "Alan, would you like to start a company?" What the hell? Straight out of college? What did I know about running companies? So anyway, I said, sure. So it's a funny story, actually. I called up Ted Sad, who's one of the old timers in the industry. Really nice, really great guy.
He was one of the first editors for Microwave Journal.
And an honest man, really, really solid guy. And I called him up and I said, Ted, I have this idea. It's a balance mixer. It does so and so. I told him about the mixer I developed at Cornell. And I said, we're thinking about starting a company with this and transformers, broadband transformers, as the first products. Do you think we should do it? I'd like your opinion. He said, well, Alan, I have my own company, Sage Laboratories. I said, yeah, I know that, but I trust you, Ted, to give me your advice. And he said, well, my advice is run with it. It's a terrific idea.
And so that was the beginning of Anzac.
That was the beginning of Anzac. So Anzac started in my kitchen with a bunch of test equipment. I don't know, remember where I ate dinner, but anyway, it was a very sparse beginning. Eventually, we moved to Stamford, Connecticut, and became a real company. But always, Carl maintained control of the stock of the company. He had been ousted from the company that was his dream, CGS Laboratories. He was not going to be booted out of Anzac Electronics. So I had some stock in the company, but I didn't have anywhere near the amount that Carl had. And I had to buy it, even though I was one of the founders and the,
Wow.
et cetera. Okay, I had to buy my stock. He felt that you should make a personal investment in it. So, as I say, when I graduated college, I was $3,000 in debt. So I wasn't exactly wealthy at the time,
Yeah, you didn't have a
but
lot of choice.
no, but indeed, if that's what Carl wanted, that's what I did. So anyway, but there have been lots of things written about Carl Sondheimer, but I can say from personal experience, I mean really close personal experience, that he was a really honest man, very straightforward. And I worked on projects with Carl that, people today would say, there's no way, because he went back when he thought there was something that might be wrong with a food processor, he simply wouldn't release it to production until it was perfect. And I had the highest respect for him as a human being. He refused to patent the braking system that we invented for the food processor because he said that safety features should be common on all food processors, and he didn't want to do anything to stand in the way of others incorporating such safety features.
Wow. So you grew Anzac into quite a significant company, and then didn't it merge with Adams Russell? And then later on, I think it got acquired by MACOM. Tell us about that progression.
Well, subsequently, through all this, the years pass, you know how it goes. Anyway, Carl had married. There were things going on. Anyway, he wanted to cash out. And so 1970, there was a sort of a downturn. He decided, well, maybe this is the right time for me to get out. And so he sold the company to Adams Russell. That was 68, I guess it was. Sold the company to Adams Russell. And I continued to work for the company, only I was now working for Adams Russell Company, not for Anzac anymore, the Anzac division of Adams Russell Company, but basically an Adams Russell employee. And there's a problem there. And that was that the arrangement made in the sales agreement was that the Anzac employees came over as Adams Russell employees with no seniority, no experience, no tail. Okay, so as far as the accrual of vacation, stock, all of that stuff, I was a brand new employee at Adams Russell Company as of whenever it was, November 1968.
Wow, that's not very good transfer over.
No, and it's Carl's fault. Carl didn't fight for the employee rights. I'm not sure he knew that he should have fought for it. All that stuff. Carl's gone. I would have asked him nose on, about it. But anyway,
yeah, I probably assumed it would just happen. Yeah.
Yes. Well, anyway, it didn't happen. And Jerry Adams was one of these people who believed in competition, competition, competition. So we had divisions within Adams Russell Company that were bidding on the same government contract against one another. I went to Jerry and I said, my job is I'm VP, I'm supposed to be helping with the technology all over Adams Russell Company. I said, you have two divisions that are working on basically the same project and bidding against one another with the government. Neither one of them wants to accept the technology I'm giving them because that would mean that they would be even with the other guys and they want to have their own special thing. I said, you're making the company just a bunch of people scrambling around. I said, there's no coordination here. He said, Alan, you don't understand. It's the Yankee way. We have competition. The best man will win. I said, yes, but your divisions are bidding themselves. You're losing profit as a consequence of what's going on. And he said, oh, I don't see it that way at all. And that was it. Well, I found it a very difficult company to work in, even though I had kind of an ideal job. It wasn't so ideal when you tried to actually implement it. And so I decided to just get out in 1970. And I came out to California, actually. I applied to Stanford. And they had a program where they were, they teamed with SRI. And you could be a part-time student at Stanford and a part-time employee at SRI. And I was married at the time, and we're thinking about having children, and so it'd be nice to be able to make a living, whereas being a student would not bring in much money. And so I thought, well, that sounded like a really great deal. Well, there were big student uprisings that year, that summer, and by the time I got to California, Stanford and SRI had separated.
Oh, wow.
And I had to choose between going to Stanford full time or going to SRI full time, but there wasn't one leg in each. And I
So
went
tell
to
us about
SRI.
SRI. You said those were some really great people that you worked with.
Oh my God, they were the smartest people, and every discipline within SRI, there are thousands of people there, and they're all super duper guys and people in their fields. And it was wonderful. And I worked for Leo Young, whose philosophy of management was, you know what to do. I'm here to facilitate it. I will coordinate this operation, my group, okay? But you guys know how to do your job. I'm just here just to make it happen. And it was really fantastic because it gave us a lot of freedom. I went to other heads of other divisions within SRI and talked about coordinating the work we were doing at my division was the Electromagnetic Techniques Group. And I was talking about incorporating communications into other areas like urban development and stuff like that, which was kind of avant-garde in those days. Today, all this stuff is one integrated whole, but then it wasn't, not at all. And SRI was leading, they were leaders in because they were multidisciplined, they could do this sort of thing. I thought it was wonderful. It's a very, very interesting job. But it turned out to be very exhausting because I really helped to sell product for the microwave, the techniques group, and I spent a lot of time on the road. Meanwhile, I was married. We were going to have a kid. This is just not going to work out very well.
So is
And
that what
so,
you led later to found Pacific Monolithics, or was there some time in between then?
there was time in between. I decided I would leave SRI, and just then I got an offer from Hewlett-Packard. And HP has always been that star in the sky in Palo Alto anyway. And gee, I had met Dave Packard. Oh, that's right. When I got a prize from the Northeast Research and Engineering meeting, I got a student paper prize for my transformer design. And Dave Packard was one of the awarders of this cash prize. So I met him. I was impressed with him. He's a good guy. And so when I went to HP in 72, I figured, I'm working for the microwave semiconductor division, I get a chance to actually mess around with those semiconductors that I had been using and the stuff that I'd built before at ANSAC and curse that. Now I have a chance to actually get in and muddle in the design. And that I did. So I was in that division. I worked in that division for a while. They changed bosses on me, which turned out to be a disaster. And anyway, I wanted out in the worst way. I finally decided to just go leave HP and got this offer from Varian. I had a lot of friends at Varian and technology. By now, because of all these, SRI and then HP semiconductors, I knew lots of people at Varian. And so they invited me to come there and be a VP of engineering at the semiconductor solid state microwave division, whatever it was. Anyway, so I said, I want out of HP. This is not working out for me here. That my boss, wherever I went within HP to try to find a different division where I could work, he interfered with it.
Wow.
And he was not a nice relationship. So I just got the hell out of there. And Varian was great. I got along great with the people there. There's only one problem. They were trying to starve that division to death. They needed a shot of money in order to refurbish the department. They needed better equipment. Their way of making semiconductors was antiquated. They needed to upgrade it. I put in a proposal to the VP for, I've forgotten how many million dollars over Yenim years, and it was rejected soundly. And he said, first the division has to start making money, then we'll put money into it to grow it. And I said, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
The chicken the and egg scenario. Making...
Yes. And they had this R&D mentality. I guess we have a little bit of time to mention this because this is the disease that was endemic in the semiconductor industry. You would make wafers that would be non-uniform in their characteristics. So some areas of the wafer would be excellent for making impact diodes, for example, of one characteristic, okay, that work at 10 gigahertz. Another area of the wafer made great impact diodes at 8 gigahertz, okay, because the layer thickness varied over the surface of the semiconductor. And so when they made these things and sampled them to the government, they could sample from the wafer the best devices for the frequency range of interest. And the performance was spectacular. Then the government said, okay, that's great. We'll give you a contract to make them by the millions. Well, wait a second. The whole process that they had was one which had non-uniform wafers so that they could pick and choose the ones that were ideal for the particular frequency of interest. This did not give you an optimized device. It gave you a whole bucket full of devices, some of which were optimized. And so the only way you could get a million of them was to make 100 million of them and pick out the million that met your requirements. This was not exactly cost-effective way to build semiconductors. And so I pointed out that you can't take the R&D flow and convert it to a production flow. You have to come up with a different technology. The way they were making them simply wasn't going to do the job, okay, unless they could refine that layer process to be much more uniform than in fact they were able to get. You know, gosh, we've been really successful competing with the other guys. What do you mean kicking sand on my baby, you know? And anyway, I guess I'd by then gotten a little bit of business acumen under my belt, and as compared with the ANZAC days when I knew zip. So I said, God, I could run a company as badly as Varian. Maybe I'll just go and start my consulting business. Yes.
So that was the genesis of Pacific Monolithics, huh?
That was when I started Podell Consulting.
Oh, Podell.
And I consulted for a number of years. Actually, one of my customers was Cuisinart because I knew Carl Sondheimer. And Carl had bought these food chopping machines from France and was very successful in importing them into the U.S. And he had some engineering things that he wanted solved. And he was delighted to be able to hire me as a consultant to work on some of the things. In fact, the first thing I worked on was a brake.
Right, back to your braking days.
Back to braking days. So then that's what I designed a brake for the food processor, which Carl just absolutely loved, incorporated immediately into the food processor. And God, I had for years, I had on the counter in my kitchen a food processor with a wire sticking out the back that loop back inside again, where I connected in the braking system, the additional braking stuff, and I still have transparent Cuisinart processors, 30-year-old transparent food processors in my kitchen, and 220 wiring from the old days of testing stuff. So
they were well made. They last that long.
Oh gosh, yes. So anyway, I had the Cuisinart customers. I had other Varian, of course, because I left Varian. I ended up consulting for Varian, HP. I consulted for HP. Actually, I consulted for HP on and off. I think the total time I worked for HP would probably give me a 10-year merit badge or something like that. But only spent 3 or 4 years there in one stretch before I left and went out and do other things. But my last customer of note was Honeywell. And Honeywell wanted to do a radar altimeter. And the radar altimeter we did in gallium arsenide. We used their digital process and designed a front end to a radar altimeter, 4.4 gigahertz. And it was really exciting. It worked. And considering that we used a digital process and managed to slither in RF design was pretty exciting. Anyway, the altimeter worked out great. The only thing is that they had already people in the company making altimeters in a different way. And they had to decide, the market wasn't that great, and they had to decide whether they were going to change manufacturing technology to the new technology or just stick with the old one and not invest in the new. And they decided, let's just stick with the old.
It's not broke, don't fix it.
That's right. So this multi-million dollar effort that I'd been working in was basically, they said, well, never mind.
So you saw the opportunity there, huh?
Yeah. So I said, geez, this is 4.4 gigahertz. I wonder about 3.7 to 4.2, which is the terrestrial satellite band back in those days. Those are the big 10-foot dishes.
Yep.
And so I used some of the chips and tried them out for 3.7 to 4.2. And no, they didn't work very well at 3.7. They worked fine well beyond 4.2. So I had to redesign the chips that basically to work over that band. And I said to the guys at Honeywell, I'm going to start a company building receiver front ends for the satellite business. Will you be the foundry? Will you make the gallium arsenide that I need to do this? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll do that. I said, that's great. We'll send you the designs. I need to get some information about costing, per wafer, because I need to know what it costs so that I can figure out my yield and go to my customer and give them a price. Oh, we can't do that. What do you mean you can't do that? Well, we don't know what it's going to cost to manufacture them. Well, I said, if you don't know what it's going to cost to manufacture them, then I don't know what to charge for them. So I won't know what to tell my customer. How do I convince my customer to buy a satellite front end from me when I don't know what the price is going to be? Well, that's your problem.
You'd think they would want to know for their own information.
Yes, maybe. So I said, well, don't you have yield information? Don't you have, they had diddly. So I ended up, by now I had a few people working with me, and we were intent on starting a company, and we went to Tektronix, and Tektronix had a foundry, gallium arsenide foundry, and I knew some of the folks there, Eric Strid, a bunch of other guys, And you know what? There is a lot of who you know in this business, I
A
guess.
small
Anyways,
industry.
it is. So anyway, I went there and I said, you guys interested in being a foundry for us? Well, yeah, we're just starting out. We'd be interested in doing that. And what are you talking about? And I said, well, if things go as predicted, we're going to use something like, I don't know, 20 wafers a month. Ooh,
That got their
that's a good
interest.
number. Okay, let's think about that. So they actually gave us then some estimates for what the wafers were going to cost. So we had fixed numbers. Given those fixed numbers, I could then go to my customer and say, this is our cost. And so we started a company, started Pacific Monolithics. And I had four guys I put together I had a station wagon, a Studebaker station wagon at the time. And it had a sliding roof. It was a roof that slid forward. So you could actually sit four people in the back looking up at the stars. I mean, you could sit in the back of the car, which was pretty funny. And sometimes we'd have meetings back there to just feel isolated, you know. But anyway, it was really a close group. And we got started. I got money from a friend of mine. I took a second mortgage on the house.
Wow, you were all in.
So I was all in. I took my gamble there. And we eventually, there were some weird things that happened along the way, but eventually we got funded by by some venture guys. And we got a pretty good bunch, actually. One of whom I thought was superlative, Reed Dennis, was one of the old timers. And I can't say enough good things about him. I thought he was a really, whatever they say bad about venture people, you can't say about Reed Dennis. He was an honest man. It was really great working with him.
And then you must have had a laid-back culture from your t-shirt, no ties.
Oh yes, oh yes. So when we started, Eric Wilson was one of our marketing guy, and he said, Doug Lockett came up with a design. Eric said, let's run with it, and so we had a whole bunch of these things turned out. And old Doug, Doug is really gung ho. He's probably still starting companies. And so one day, if you can imagine, I walked into the auditorium where the speech, the what you call it, the this is the microwave symposium, the big meeting where the big introductory meeting speech, what have you, suppose. Anyway, the auditorium was empty, the chairs were set up, no one was around, and I had what was supposed to be posters that were supposed to be stickers that were supposed to be posted on the for job employment, okay, at Pacific Monolithics are supposed to be going on the wall. Well, I looked around the room and I swear there were Doug and Eric with me, and we went through there and peeled off these solicitations, and every single chair in that auditorium had a Pacific Monolithics solicitation for, come work at Pacific Monolithics, no neckties. No necktie culture, blah blah blah. Okay, and of course we all wore these no neckties
Nice.
T-shirts. And oh, did we get it from the organizers of the MTT? Oh my God,
Yeah, they
what was
probably didn't
at?
take kindly to that kind of promotion.
No, but it was after. What do you do afterward? You know.
So, can you tell us about your days of at Besser Associates? You're a lead instructor there, VP of Technology.
Yes, well, I had an awful lot of gallium arsenide technology under my belt, from my years at Pacific Monolithics, actually. So I was able to teach a bunch of stuff about gallium arsenide. And then it turned out that they also needed somebody to teach just plain old RF courses. And that was something I was dear to my heart, so I did that. And then I'd always battled with EMI problems and stuff I'd built. And there was a course that they needed put together for electromagnetic interference and shielding. So I used Anatoly Tsiolkovich's book as the core of my work, and then put together a course based on that, using it for reference. But basically it was a completely separate course. It was just nice to have curves and things to refer back to in the book. But if you're talking about an hour or two course, and we're talking about a 400 page book or whatever it is, you need to distill somewhat to get the material across.
Just a little.
So anyway, it was interesting because I was kind of the Gal Friday at Besser. I remember that one of the instructors took sick, and so they needed this course taught. I forgot where it was now, but it was some distance away. So I had 1 week to learn his course and present it. Boy, I'll tell you, day and night, I spent studying that course, because it had to be perfect. You know, I had to know every single thing. And students, you know, you're not teaching school kids who are, you know, coming with empty heads. You're talking about people who are experienced, so they ask you really good questions, so you have to be prepared for anything, you know.
Yeah. So you've you've authored over 70 papers, you have over 60 patents. Mm-hmm. Which inventions did you find the most interesting, and any that you think have potential for the future?
Well, actually, the work that I've done with Whirlitone on transformers eventually will ooze out into the marketplace. You know, all of it's been done proprietary. I guess I always wondered whether I should have worked at Bell Labs instead. You know, what that would have made, how that would have changed my life. But anyway, I've done some stuff with magnetics, ferrite, that and transform broadband and transformer design that's just not gotten out to the world. Okay, the people at Whirlitone use the technology to build broadband high power directional couplers, hybrids, but we have really it's a different approach to doing it, and basically we've more or less eliminated the problem of the ferrite loss getting into the transmission characteristics of the lines that you put on the transformer. So you can essentially look at the transformer as a transmission line transformer, and the ferrite as the material that raises the permeability so that you can use it down to a low frequency. And that's it. It takes a little fancy two-step, but it's been very interesting working in that area. A lot of things come from making things smaller. And you can only make them smaller if you can get the heat out. And you can only get the heat out if you make it more efficient. And typically when you make things with smaller conductor sizes, the dissipation goes up, it doesn't go down. So it's been fascinating working right up against the laws of physics. When they come up with better printed circuit board materials, for example, that helped me wick out my power and get get the heat out. I might change the configuration of the transformer in order to take advantage of that and get much wider bandwidth, because I can now make it smaller, and that takes me down a different path. I found that it's just the area of where ferrite meets transmission line transformer is an area that is just a labyrinth of possibilities. And I think in the future, you'll find that people will be building power supplies to tens or hundreds of megahertz, leaning on some of these techniques that we developed. It's all patented. I mean, it's all in the literature. It's patented. I mean, anybody, you can go look in the patents and see what stuff is there and do what you want with it. And my theory is, shame on you if you don't search the patents before you go and work on something, because you're ignoring, 5,000 years of intelligence. What are you doing, you idiot? You have to have some sort of thing wrong with you that says I'm going to do it all myself and I'm not going to pay any attention to what anybody else has done. No, you pay attention to what other people have done. But at the same time, you can say, I don't know. Why is that better than doing so-and-so? And in fact, I worked with Seymour Cohn and Leo Young. Seymour Cohn did a really interesting splitter where he took the Wilkinson splitter, which is just a two-way, and made it multi-step. And in a very, very simple design approach where he said, gee, all this is a transformer. I'm going, if I want to make a two-way, broadband two-way, I have 150 ohm input, 250 ohm outputs, but the two outputs are in phase so that I can parallel them. Basically, all I'm doing is building a broadband 2-to-1 transformer, 50 to 25 ohms, and I'll just design a multiple step something or other transformer that gets me from 50 to 25 ohms, and then I'll split it and use twice the impedance lines on each side. And now I can put a resistor across between each place, each quarter wave jump in the multi-step transformer. And I can use the multi-step transformer to take care of my even mode. And because I put resistors across at each junction, I can eat the energy that comes back differentially. And then I can have isolation between the output ports at the same time and not add any loss to the structure. Well, I looked at that and I said, oh, God, that's clever. That's really a neat idea. But then when you try to build it, some of those resistors, the values are ridiculously high, hundreds of ohms. We can't use that if you're trying to build a 2-to-8 splitter. No, 2-to-8 gigahertz, hundreds of ohms, no way. Get any heat out? Nah. So I said, maybe there's another way. So I looked at this thing, and it's funny, I was physically holding one of these up in the air, looking at it from the two prong end where there are two 50 ohm outputs. And I said, hey, why don't I just propagate the wave between the wires? So I just allowed coupling between the wires that feed the two connectors, the two outputs, instead of bringing them out independently. I allowed the two lines to couple. If you do that, it doesn't affect the common mode, but it affects the differential, because now the differential sees the two lines as carrying currents in opposite directions, and you can propagate a wave down there. Aha! So now I can pull the resistor off, and I can make the impedance between the wires such that it looks like there was a resistor there. And I can do that clunka 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 down the step transmission line transformer right to the very beginning and end up with one resistor in a Seymour cone divider by collapsing all the other resistors down to one by allowing coupling between the two sides of the split transformer. That's not too complicated an explanation, even verbally, I hope.
No.
And so that way, by the way, it turns out that resistor turns out to be like 40 to 50 ohms. Nice value for RF guys. Love numbers like that. And so it worked like a charm. And it's not quite as good as the multi-step thing done with Seymour's approach where you use resistors. On the other hand, it doesn't have any extra loss because the it doesn't have those weird high-value resistors in there. It just has that one, and that's easy to deal with. So I told Seymour about that, and he said, gee, now that's an interesting idea. I said, Seymour, it's your idea. All I did was add the icing to the cake. And it was wonderful working with people like Seymour Cohn and Leo Young. They always, you know, they could see instantly what you were doing and where you were going. It's really nice to be able to communicate with people, you know, that slick. God, it's just fantastic. Carl Sondheimer was another person like that, by the way. He was a very, very bright guy, and he could capture new concepts very easily. He understood them. I always said I had my head screwed on kind of crooked because I always look at things more than one way, just in case there's something different to be seen.
Well, you said you were very good at looking at things from a very high point of view, 10, 20,000 mm-hmm. foot view, and you worked with a lot of good people who could really understand the engineering details. Does that right. trace back to, you know, any of your work, or is that just kind of how you were, your mind thinks at all?
Yeah, in fact, I sort of caught on to that, I've tried to work with people who are really good with their hands, who are really good with their, you know, there are people around who have instinct. You know, they're the guys who, when they tune the unit up, they just have a hunch that if they turned the third screw a little bit more, that would fix it. And I'll be dipped if I can figure out how they figure out that sort of stuff. But there are people who have that sort of, you know, have that sense. And it's nice to, that's the same as true from a design point of view. So you come up with an approach, or I do, come up with an approach. I say, you know, I'll sit in my living room and stare at the wall. Okay, I have a problem to work on. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. And I'll have an idea, and I'll kind of rough it out, and then I'll send it to my friend Heian. And Heian said, well, that's an interesting idea. Let me simulate that and see what I can make of it. But I like the idea at first, except for this. Maybe we could improve that. See, you're not so smart. You know, I'm not so smart.
Oh, I come you got up with it this started. Thing.
Yeah, but I got it started. And then somebody else says, you know, that could be made a little bit better. And somebody else says, that could be made a little bit better. And, you know, you realize that there's almost nothing that's built, that's done in the world, that's done by an individual acting alone. You're always building on something. It's something you heard or something you saw or something you stepped in. You know, you don't really invent in a vacuum. I just don't believe that. But intuition means you have to toss a whole bunch of stuff up in the air and see where it falls. And I think that's where I, that's my area of expertise. I wish I could teach that to somebody, you know, how you do that. I don't know.
Yeah, not everything's teachable.
Yeah.
So, you know, stepping back, looking at all your years and working in the industry, you know, looking forward, what do you think are some of the biggest advances that will take place in the next 5 to 10 years that will really make a big difference in the industry going forward?
Well, one of the things I've noticed in recent times has fascinated me is that the simulators have gotten so damn good that you don't have to simulate a printed circuit board. You don't have to simulate a waveguide assembly. You don't have to simulate a coaxial assembly. You can take the whole enchilada and put it together, draw it up, and darned if you can't simulate the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, it might take 6 hours to run the simulation. You're not going to run iterative optimizations on something like that. So you'd better know what the hell you're doing before you put it together. But the point is that we have passed the point where we have to build things piecewise. And my claim is that if you design something as a completely integrated whole, it means that it's going to be a more efficient design than if you try to build it up out of pieces A, B, C, D, E. Okay. Every time you try to fit an A into a B and a B into a C, there's some error in, there's a crunching error there or something. Okay. So nothing ever works as well as you would predict from the initial guesstimates. But if you have more in the guesstimate in the first place, you've simulated the whole thing, and there aren't any gotchas there because you have simulated the gotcha. So I predict in the next 10 years that something that I'm just beginning to do now, but people will do a lot more of, is that people will begin to simulate entire things well. And that doesn't throw out the engineer. It just means that, it gives you more work actually, because you have to know what you're doing and you're putting it together. But you don't test each part individually is what I'm saying.
Yeah, more hours designing and less prototyping.
That's right. Yep. So I think that's one of the things. The other thing is adaptive. Okay. I think that's a really exciting thing in the future, is that instead of tweaking, they'll be adding in adaptability to stuff so that it no longer has to be perfect by design, but it is perfect for application. And the thing will know it's being used. It knows what's happening to it, and it self-adapts to the environment that you're asking it to perform in. And that's not true today, but I swear to you, with the electronics working, you know, with the digital stuff working as quickly as it does, that's going to happen. People are going to get rid of all those screws, and they're going to simply make stuff that's more and more and more self-adaptive to the environment they have.
Yeah, a true cognitive radar system or software-defined radio is really coming into play here.
Yeah, unfortunately, software-defined radios come with their own set of real uglies. And, you know, people tell me what the specs are, like intermodulation distortion. I say, holy crow, you have to live with that stuff? Well, we get around it this way, anyway... You know, nothing, you don't get anything for free. You know, signal to noise ratio does apply no matter what you do, you know. That's the other thing I must say is that I always that physics background, I can't help it. Whenever somebody gives me something, the first thing I do is I lean on my physics background and I say, does this make sense? Is this the best way of doing it? And an engineer says, let's just get it done. You know, if this gets it done quickly, that's fine. And I always look at it and I say, you know, is that, do I understand it completely? Is that really making the most of it? There isn't time enough today, but anyway, I had that experience with directional couplers where I discovered that because the mathematics were easy, people had taken what was actually a large design base and had gone off in a particular way to do their designs because the mathematics was easy, okay? But it left out a whole class of other designs that were not modeled, not within that realm. So it's
Yes,
interesting.
so true. Well, thank you, Alan, for taking the time to talk with me today and share your experiences and knowledge. We are truly blessed to have you in the industry, and you truly are an industry icon. For our listeners, please check out our podcast and future episodes of RF Industry Icons at podcast.microwavejournal.com. Thank you.